I had intended to finish up the series on why we don't celebrate Christmas today, and then I had some other thoughts after last Sunday, and I've added in some more section to the outline. So anyway, I'll, Lord willing, finish it up next Sunday, not this Sunday. And as I was poking around on the internet looking for something, I found an interesting quote from an Islamic website called aboutislam.net. And I just found it interesting that the Muslims understand more about Christmas than most Christians do. And I wanted to read this to you. It says, "Christmas was a pagan custom which was adopted into Christianity. It has nothing to do with reverence and love of Jesus, the mighty messenger of Allah, that we Muslims hold in the highest regard and respect. If Jesus were to come today, whether or not he would identify himself with those who celebrate Christmas is a question one should ask seriously." And I thought that was pretty true. I mean, not the messenger of Allah part, obviously, but the fact that they know that Christmas is a pagan holiday and it has nothing to do with honoring Jesus Christ. And if Jesus came back today, would he even associate himself with people that are celebrating Christmas? Is a good question to ask. So they have plenty of problems, but at least they have Christmas figured out anyway, which is more than I can say for a lot of our own brethren out there in the world. So last time I left off talking about how, first of all, showing that Christmas is a pagan holiday, just renamed, and then after proving that extensively, then we looked at what the scripture says about doing the very thing that people are doing this time of year, and that is incorporating a pagan holiday into God's religion. And we saw there from Deuteronomy chapter 12 that God forbids us doing that. And I want to pick up from there and look at some other passages in the, first of all, in the Old Testament, and then even in the New Testament, which teach the same thing, that God forbids his people from learning the way of the heathen, from worshiping him the way that the heathen do. And I want to turn you, first of all, to Jeremiah chapter 10, verses 2 through 4. And I read the part of Jeremiah 10 in the before the sermon today for this purpose, to give you the context of what this is speaking of here. The Lord is comparing himself with the idols of the heathen that they worship. And in Jeremiah 10, 2 through 4, it says, "Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them." Now, it's just interesting that as we continue reading down through here, we're going to see two things that are connected together. Idolatry, which has to do with trees, and learning the way of the heathen and being dismayed at the signs of heaven. And this pretty well fits the context of Christmas very well, because Christmas came about, the holiday that Christmas hijacked, Natalis Solis Invicti, came about by heathen looking at the heavens and being dismayed at the signs of heaven. They saw, as the year progressed from June to December, that the sun continues to get lower and lower in the sky. And now it comes up, you know, in the south, kind of goes across the south sky, and the days are get shorter and shorter and shorter. And they noticed, probably over the years, that about December 21st, at the winter solstice, the sun's in its lowest point in the sky, the days are the shortest, and then after that, the days start to lengthen, the sun begins to regain its strength, and this is what they were celebrating, the birth of the unconquered sun. They were looking at the signs of heaven, in other words, looking at the stars and the heavenly host and deriving their religion from that instead of worshiping the creator that created it all. Now look at what's connected with that. Verse 3, "For the customs of the people are vain, for one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with hammer or with nails and with hammers that it move not." Now, what does that sound like to you? It sounds like a Christmas tree. It sounds like what people do, what people used to do before artificial trees. This is what everybody did. They went out to the forest. They took an axe with them. They chopped down a spruce or some kind of an evergreen tree. They brought it back into their house. They fastened it with hammers and nails. They probably tied little strings to it and put a nail in the floor so that the thing wouldn't fall over. And then they decorated it with silver and gold. And we still do that today, right? To deck means to decorate. Remember the old Balmis' song, Deck the Halls with Boughs of Holly, right? To deck is to decorate. They deck it with silver and gold. And we use, don't people still use silver and gold tinsel today? So it looks like the tree's decorated with silver and gold. This perfectly matches the practice of using a Christmas tree in your worship of God. And yet, what does the Bible say? Learn not the way of the heathen. Don't do that. Now, somebody will say, oh, but this isn't referring to a Christmas tree. This is referring to an idol. To which I would reply, what's the difference? Number one, right? Yeah, I agree. It's referring to an idol. So is a Christmas tree. But, oh, that's referring to somebody going out and cutting a tree and then carving it up into an idol. Okay. So, again, what is the difference? Whether you chop the limbs off the tree and carve it up into a little idol and decorate it with silver and gold, or you decorate the tree before you chop the limbs off with silver and gold, whether you fasten it with hammer and nail so the little idol that you made doesn't topple over, or you do the same thing with your Christmas tree, what is the difference? Right? There's no difference here. It's just the shape, the size, and the appearance of the idol is the only difference. You're still cutting a tree out of the forest. You're decorating it with silver and gold. It's the same thing. It's all under the condemnation of God. And you know, people might say, well, I'm not. This is not an idol. I'm not worshiping this. But do you know where this comes from? Right? This was brought into Christianity, so-called, from the Germanic tribes hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Something that they did to celebrate the winter solstice. This was brought in. This is where the Christmas tree comes from. So it was literally from the heathen that were worshiping their gods using green trees at the winter solstice. It's the same thing. And God says, don't do it. See, green tree worship is old. Old as the hills. Green trees have been associated with pagan idolatry since ancient times. And God hates worship that is done with green trees. And I'll give you some verses here. 1 Kings 14:22-24. 1 Kings 14:22-24. It's almost as if God foresaw the future and put things in his word that apply to what happens today. Though they might have been done slightly differently at that time, what they were doing then applies very, very closely to what's being done today. 1 Kings 14:22-24. And Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins, which they had committed, above all that their fathers had done. For they also built them high places, and images and groves on every high hill, and under every green tree. So here they are worshiping under green trees. Now, in the summertime, all trees are green, pretty much. So this is probably referring to evergreen trees, right? They're green all the time, right? So this is why they're referring to it as a green tree. The evergreen tree was a symbol of life, right? It was still looks alive in the wintertime when everything else is dead, which is why it came to symbolize the rebirth of the sun. But look what also is associated with green tree worship, the next verse. And there were also Sodomites in the land, and they did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. Now, those two verses are connected with an and. You see that? So they worshipped under green trees, and there were Sodomites in the land. These two things are associated. Like when people go after idolatry and they forsake the true God, you know what they do next? They go into sodomy. Read about it in Romans chapter 1. When they did not want to retain God in their knowledge, he gave them up to vile affection, and their women used the women and men with men, working that which is unseemly, and so on. You know that passage in Romans chapter 1. So idolatry, rejecting the true God, leads to sodomy, and this is what we see here. Let me ask you just a simple question. Do you think that we have more sodomy in this country now or in, say, 1824, 200 years ago, before the country was in mass celebrating Christmas? Do you suppose we have more sodomites now or then? Let's even factor in population change. Okay, there's a lot more people now. Okay, Do you think the percentage of the population now has more percentage of sodomites than it did back in 1824? Now, am I saying that is the only reason that we have sodomites in the land today because we celebrate Christmas? No, not the only reason, but this is just one of the many things that people have done to reject the true God and his true worship, and this has contributed to the state that our society is in. Let's look at 2 Kings 17, 10 through 12. 2 Kings 17, 10 through 12. And guess what? These God-hating, God-rejecting sodomites, I would venture to bet every single one of them celebrates Christmas. They don't want anything to do with Jesus Christ, but they love celebrating Christmas. And that's the case with pretty much everybody in this country, with rare exception. But I'll get to that point later. 2 Kings 17, 10 through 12. That's 1 Kings. 2 Kings 17, 10 through 12. And they set them up images, these are idols, and groves in every high hill and under every green tree. And there they burn incense in all the high places, as did the heathen whom the Lord carried away before them, and wrought wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger. For they served idols, whereof the Lord had said unto them, ye shall not do this thing. Again, idolatry associated with green tree worship. Under green trees. So today, I'm getting ahead of myself, but today we have idolatry happening under green trees. Because the Bible says that covetousness is idolatry. And so you have idolatry, covetousness happening literally under green trees where all the presents are put and all the children are taught to be covetous and uncontent and greedy. But I'll get to a little more of that later. And then Jeremiah 2 and verse 20. Jeremiah 2 and verse 20. For of old time I have broken thy yoke and burst thy bands, and thou saidst, I will not transgress, when upon every high hill and under every green tree thou wanderest, playing the harlot. God refers to idolatry as harlotry, as spiritual fornication. And people should remember that when they're celebrating Christmas, because it's as if they are playing the harlot against God. They are using former lovers from ages past where people would commit idolatry and sacrilege with these pagan gods, and they have taken this into their own religion, and they're committing spiritual fornication and adultery against the Lord. Now, somebody might say, well, yeah, but this doesn't apply to me because I don't cut a tree out of the forest. I don't go out there and I don't have to fasten it with hammers and nails because I've got a plastic one, right? I've got an artificial one, so I'm good, because I'm not cutting a tree out of the forest. I'm not fashioning myself an idol. I paid some poor little kid in China to do it for me, right? But artificial trees don't cut it either. Let's look at Isaiah 40, 20 through 19 through 20. Isaiah 40, 19 through 20. I'm using a principle here. This is not referring to an artificial Christmas tree, but I think you'll get the point. Isaiah 40, 19 through 20. It says, the workman melteth the graven image, and the goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold, and casteth silver chains. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooseth a tree that will not rot. He seeketh unto him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. So this poor guy is so impoverished that he has to pick a tree that won't rot. He has himself an artificial idol anyway. Kind of like an artificial tree that won't rot. Another thing that was set, that was accompanied with green tree worship, in addition to sodomy, was child sacrifice. I touched on this last time, but let's look at a couple of verses. 2 Kings 16, 3 through 4. 1 Kings 16, 3 through 4. idolatrous nations are set headed for destruction. If you think about it, here you have a nation, there you had a nation, where you had sodomites, which don't reproduce themselves, and then the people that were reproducing themselves were burning their children in the fire to false gods. So you have a society here that is having decreased birth rates and fertility rates because of sodomy and because of child sacrifice. And as I mentioned the other day, what do we have here in the U.S.? A nation of decreased birth rates and fertility rates going down and down and down. History repeats itself, or it at least rhymes. 2 Kings 16, 3 through 4. But he walked, this was that wicked king Ahaz, right? Yeah, I don't know if you remember or not, you probably do. I preached through this chapter extemporaneously about King Ahaz several years ago. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, yea, and he made his son to pass through the fire according to the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel. Now Ahaz was a king of Judah. He was actually the son of a good king, if I remember right. I think Hezekiah. I'd have to look back at that, though. But anyway, he... I don't want to get sidetracked. He was a king of Judah anyway, which was the godly kingdom, right? The kingdom of Israel was the northern kingdom that had rejected the Lord and gone after Jeroboam with the idols and all that. But Ahaz is a godly king, but he's walking after the ways of the kings of Israel. He's walking after the ways of the heathen, right? So a good parallel here. Here's a man that should be in God's nation and God's religion, but he's walking according to the ways of the heathen. And look what happens. Verse 4, and he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. Associate, there it says he made his son to pass through the fire. Sacrificed his own son, worshiping under green trees. And then Isaiah 57, verse 5. Isaiah 57 and verse 5. Inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree, slaying the children in the valleys under the cliffs of the rocks. So child sacrifice with green tree worship. And is it any wonder that abortion, which is child sacrifice, and abortion really is a euphemism. We shouldn't even really use that term. It's infanticide is what it is. Abortion is a natural process where a woman's body, you know, has a miscarriage essentially and then aborts, gets rid of the baby. Abortion is not really a proper term. It's infanticide. It's child murder is what it really is. But anyway, is it any wonder that infanticide, child sacrifice, is rampant in a society that is enamored with Christmas and green tree worship? It was the same way back then. They were worshiping under green trees and killing their kids. We're worshiping under green trees today and killing our kids. Is there anything new under the sun? And then you remember what happened with Israel when they were in the wilderness and Moses went up on the mountain. He didn't come back for a long time and the people didn't know what was become of him. And they asked Aaron to make them gods. And so he tells them to go ahead and turn to Exodus 32. He tells them to take off their golden earrings and their jewelry. And poor old Aaron, he just threw all that stuff into the fire and a calf popped out just spontaneously. That's what he said anyway. And it's funny how we... After the fact, when we tell stories, how they get slightly altered that make us look maybe just not quite so bad. Instead of, you know, I fashioned an idol, I threw him into the fire and out popped this calf, right? It's funny how that happens. That's why you always want to listen to both sides of every story, because when you listen to one side of the story, you generally maybe get just a bit of a skewed view. That's human nature. Anyway, so Israel learns the way of the heathen here. Aaron makes him this golden calf, and he pronounces and proclaims that tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. Exodus 32, 5 through 6. And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord, all in caps, Jehovah. He didn't say tomorrow is a feast unto Baal. He didn't say tomorrow is a feast unto this false god, this idol that I've just built here. He said tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. He's got this idol that he's built. He's got an altar for it. It's sitting there, but he says it's a feast to the Lord. we are going to worship the Lord using this idol that I made. We're going to bring in this pagan practice, and we're going to use it in the worship of the Lord. Does that sound familiar to you? Verse 6, and they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Now, Paul quotes this passage in 1 Corinthians 10:7, and he calls this practice of incorporating heathenism into God's religion, he calls it idolatry, and forbids Christians from doing such evil. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 7. 1 Corinthians 10:7. You don't just have to bow down to an idol to be an idolater, and I'll talk about that later in the sermon today. 1 Corinthians 10:7. Neither be ye idolaters as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. He's quoting Exodus 32. He says they were idolaters. But what did they specifically do to be idolaters? They had a feast to the Lord with an idol present. What does that sound like? It sounds very similar to Christmas. It's a feast to the Lord, don't you know? We're celebrating the birth of Jesus, except we've got this green tree here, and we've got all these pagan practices, and we're doing it on the same day as the pagans worship the sun, and we're doing it in the same exact way as they worship the sun, right? It's basically the same thing. Now, somebody might say, well, yeah, but you've only given Old Testament references so far. That yes, God forbid idolatry in the Old Testament, but that's Old Testament. Apparently, he's okay with idolatry now. Well, he's not okay with idolatry now either. Not learning the way of the heathen is a New Testament precept as well as an Old Testament precept. Jesus taught that we are not to do as the heathen do. Matthew 6 and verse 7. Specifically when it comes to our religion. Yes, I know, the heathen eat food and the heathen drive cars and the heathen do all kinds of things, right? They breathe air and they drink water and they sit in chairs too. I'm talking about, and Jesus is talking about, religious things. You don't learn the way of the heathen religiously. You don't pray like they do. You don't worship like they do. You don't honor God the way that they do. Matthew 6 and verse 7. Matthew 6, 7. But when ye pray, this is part of your religion, part of your spiritual relationship with God. But when ye pray, use not vain repetitions as the heathen do, for they think that they should be heard for their much speaking. So we're not to pray like the heathen. Now it's interesting, the Catholic Church, which took the heathen holiday of Natalis Solis Invictus and brought it in and called it Christmas, what else do they do like the heathen? They pray like the heathen. They use vain repetitions. They pray the rosary. And they, what do they say, the Lord's Prayer like 50-some times or something when they pray the rosary? And then they say the prayer to Mary. I forget what it's called. But anyway, those, they just repeat them over and over and over again. They think that they will be heard through their much speaking. It just... Real quick side note there. I just find it so fascinating that Jesus says, when you pray, use not vain repetition as the heathen do. Here's how you pray. And he gives them an outline of a prayer. He gives them like the basics, the basic components of a prayer. Here's how you pray. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, and so on. And what do the Catholics do? They take the pattern of a prayer and they repeat it verbatim 50 times over again in vain repetitions. It's fascinating to me. I don't know how you can miss it, but anyway. We're told not to be yoked with unbelievers nor their idolatrous religions. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 6:14 through 18. 2 Corinthians 6:14 through 18. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. So he's talking to a church here. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what concord hath light with darkness? And what, what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? And what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols, like green trees? For ye are the temple of the living God, as God hath said, I will dwell in them, and will walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you. And I will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. Christ has no concord with Belial, with a devil. The temple of God hath no agreement with idols, with green trees, and so on. And, well, that's not a... We got some greenery in here, but it's not our fault, right? We're just using the room. But churches that own their own building decorate them up with this kind of garbage themselves, intentionally. What agreement hath the temple of God with idols? I mean, their building's not the temple of God, but their temple of God meets in that building, and they've decorated it up with idols. Happens all the time. The Bible teaches us that the things that the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 10, 20 through 21. 1 Corinthians 10, 20 through 21. But this I say, that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God. And I would not that ye should have fellowship with devils. Ye cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. Ye cannot be partakers of the Lord's table and of the table of devils. Whether or not those Gentiles, he's referring to like pagan, heathen people, whether or not they even knew that they were sacrificing to devils doesn't matter. What they were in fact doing was sacrificing to devils. When they celebrated those sun-worshipping holidays, those sun-worshipping feasts and observances, they were sacrificing to devils, whether they knew it or not. They probably didn't know it. When they bowed down to that stump, when they made that little stone or that little wooden idol or that idol of gold, they were sacrificing and worshiping devils. This is what Paul's saying here. And he says, I would not that ye should have fellowship with devils. You can't have it both ways. You can't drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. You can't mix idolatry in with God's religion. You're either going to worship God or you're going to worship devils. Those are your two choices. Christians, well, Romans, that worship the sun during Natalis Solis Invicti were worshiping devils. Christians who celebrate Christmas, which is Natalis Solis Invicti renamed, are worshiping devils, whether they know it or not. Like I said, you can't have it both ways. You're either going to worship God or you're going to worship devils. You might say, well, I'm not worshiping devils. I'm honoring the birth of Christ. I'm not worshiping devils. Those pagans would have said the same thing. I'm not worshiping devils. This little statue that I have in my house, he's not a devil. Well, Paul says otherwise. God hated sun worship so much that he punished it by death in the law of Moses. Deuteronomy 17, 2 through 5. Deuteronomy 17, 2 through 5. Listen to this. If there be found among you within any of thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, man or woman that hath wrought wickedness in the sight of the Lord thy God, in transgressing his covenant, and hath gone and served other gods and worshipped them. Now, look and see who the other gods are that they served and worshipped. Either the sun or moon or any of the host of heaven, the stars, which I have not commanded. See, when people worshiped the sun, they were worshiping other gods. They believed that sun was a god. So the worship of the sun and the moon was worshiping other gods. And it be told thee, and thou hast heard of it, and inquired diligently, and behold, it be true, and the thing certain, that such abomination is wrought in Israel. Then shalt thou bring forth that man or that woman which have committed that wicked thing unto thy gates, even that man or that woman, and shall stone them with stones till they die. It was a death penalty to worship the sun in those days. And in the New Testament church, it still is. It's just a spiritual death penalty. You're put out of the fellowship, out of the church. I will talk about that in a minute. Jesus told us that we are to do whatsoever, all things, whatsoever he commanded us in Matthew 28 and verse 20. And there's a lot that is encompassed in this little saying here. Matthew 28 and verse 20. Jesus said, let's just get verse 19 for the whole sentence. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Amen. Two things there. He says, teach them all things whatsoever I have commanded you. If we do all things Jesus commands, we can't leave anything out. Right? If you do all things, you can't do all but one all things, right? If you do all things, you do them all. You can't leave even one out, right? And if we do whatsoever he commands, we can't add in anything extra, can you? If I tell you, do whatsoever I tell you, do whatever I tell you to do, does that mean that you can go off and do something else? No. It means you do exactly what I told you to do, and you don't do anything else. And if I say, do all things whatsoever I command you, it means you do each and everything I told you and nothing more and nothing less. That is exactly what Jesus is telling us to do. This is what the apostles were to preach, and I'm preaching what they're preaching. We are told to keep the ordinances as delivered. Paul told us this in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 2. I'm building up to a point here in just a second. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 2. In verse 1, Paul says, be ye followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. Now I praise you, brethren, that ye remember me in all things, and keep the ordinances as I delivered them to you. Keep the ordinances, number one, so do the ordinance, but then specifically, do it as I delivered it unto you. In the way in which I told you to do the ordinances, do it that way. Okay? If you didn't know this, a little reading of the Bible will teach you or tell you that God is a stickler for doing it his way. You remember Nadab and Abihu, they offered strange fire? I mean, they burned some incense, they offered some fire. It probably wasn't like altogether completely unheard of what they did, but it was something was a little different about it. It was strange. It was foreign. They did something wrong at the wrong time, wrong place, wrong incident. They did something. It doesn't really say specifically what they did wrong, but they did something wrong, and God burned them up immediately. Uzzah, when they were moving the ark, the oxen stumble. The ark's ready to fall on the ground and get destroyed. And Uzzah does what just about any man would do in such a situation. He reaches up and steadies the ark so it doesn't fall down. And God killed him for it because he wasn't supposed to touch it. Think about that. Think about that. And there are many more examples in the Bible of God saying, you do it just the way that I tell you to do it or else there's going to be punishment. Now, Jesus said, do all things whatsoever I commanded you. And Paul says, keep the ordinances as delivered. Christmas was never commanded by Jesus or the apostles. And in that it's a religious observance, it ought not to be done. Now, people might say, well, the Bible never says we're supposed to drive cars either, so you can't drive a car to church. You ever heard a dumb argument like that? I hear them all the time. I mean, this is a common argument that people make against this. I'm talking about religious observances. Paul is talking about religious ordinances. Jesus was talking about his commandments pertaining to his religion. Right? You don't mess with those commandments. You don't add things in. You don't take things away. If God didn't command you to celebrate Christmas, it's because he doesn't want you to celebrate Christmas. Because if he wanted you to celebrate Christmas, which is a spiritual observance of the celebration of the birthday of his son, supposedly, if he wanted you to do that, he would have told you to do that. And the fact that he did not mention it means he does not want it done. or he would have told you when and how to do it. And he certainly doesn't want it done with exchanging gifts and kissing under mistletoe and putting wreaths in your house and singing Christmas carols and burning Yule logs and sitting on Santa's lap and all this other garbage. He certainly does not want that done. God will severely judge those who mix elements of his religion with heathen religion and sin. Now, I'm not going to read this passage, but it's in Daniel chapter 5. You'll probably remember that. There was a man named Belshazzar. He was the king of Babylon after Nebuchadnezzar had passed on. And Belshazzar threw a great big party. I think it was for like 1,000 of his lords or something. And they were drinking and partying. And he got out the vessels that they had taken from Jerusalem when they destroyed the temple. And they brought them to Babylon. He gets the vessels, the cups and all that. And they start drinking wine and praising the gods of gold and silver. And they're basically taking elements of God's religion and they're combining it with their own heathen idolatry. And in the middle of the party, they see a handwriting on the wall. And it scares the wits out of them. And he calls in Daniel to interpret it. And it said, "Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin," which being interpreted is, "Thou hast been weighed in the balance and found wanting, and thy kingdom is given to the Medes and the Persians." And that very night, Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian ransacked Babylon, and Belshazzar was killed. You don't mix elements of God's religion with heathen religion and sin. And God does not appreciate do-it-yourself religion either. Let's look at 1 Kings 12, 28 through 33. See, Christmas is do-it-yourself religion. God never said to do it, and people just dreamed up this holiday that God never commanded and certainly does not want done. And God doesn't appreciate such things. I'll give you an example of such. I just mentioned the Northern Kingdom here a minute ago. At one time under David and Solomon, Israel was one kingdom. And then when Solomon died, his son Rehoboam was to take the throne, and Rehoboam foolishly wouldn't listen to the people and lighten their load a bit. Solomon had been quite the taskmaster. And the people rebelled, and 10 of the tribes broke off. And the 10 northern tribes became known as Israel, and the 2 southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, became known as the tribe of Judah, the nation of Judah. And in the northern tribes, they had a man named Jeroboam that was their king. And Jeroboam was concerned that if he allowed the people in the northern tribes to travel down to Jerusalem 3 times a year to worship, which is what they were what they had to do. This is what the law said they had to do. If they went down to the temple in Jerusalem 3 times a year, good communication might corrupt their bad manners, so to speak. Right? They might actually learn the religion of the true God and realize that they're wrong, right? So Jeroboam decides he'll make his own religion. And he made some calves, probably got the idea from Aaron, made some golden calves and put them in Dan and Bethel, 2 cities up in northern Israel. And he built a house there of worship and said people can go here to worship now. And he made their own holiday, their own religious holiday. He even made his own priests. So he created his own church, his own religion, his own preachers, his own religious holidays. He just made it all up. Pretty much like what people have done today. Let me read it to you. 1 Kings 12, 28 through 33. "Whereupon the king took counsel and made 2 calves of gold and said unto them, It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt," which is exactly what his father Aaron had said many years before. "But it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Gas prices are high. It's just expensive to travel these days. It's just too much. You can't be going up to Jerusalem all the time. Let's have church a little closer to home." There's lots of people, they would not drive more than 5 minutes to go to church. They will let their church and their religion be determined by what is within 5 minutes of their geographical location. There's lots of people like that. They literally would not drive 5 minutes more to find a church. They'll just go to whatever one they can find that's nice and close. Let alone driving an hour or two. Most people won't even think of it. And he set the one in Bethel, and the other put he in Dan. And this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one, even unto Dan. It became a sin. God doesn't like, you know, incorporating heathenism into his religion. And he made an house of high places. So he makes a house of worship here. And made priests to the lowest of the people. So he makes his own preachers too. Which were not of the sons of Levi. They weren't called men of God. They weren't ordained. They had no business being in the priesthood. And he just made it up. You don't worry about being in some lineage of preachers. Just, you know, go to college. You want to be a preacher? You just go to college. You'll be a preacher. Don't worry about being trained by a real one. And Jeroboam ordained a feast in the 8th month, on the 15th day of the month, like unto the feast that is in Judah, and he offered upon the altar. So he makes a feast. He makes a religious holy day, a holiday. You know, that's where the word holiday comes from, right? Holy day. He makes a feast, a holy day, a holiday. And he makes it look like the one that's in Judah, so he makes it very similar. But he dreams up his own thing. He makes his own thing, but he tries to make it look, you know, all Christian-y. Kind of like maybe bringing a pagan holiday into your religion, but then giving it Christian terminology and, you know, making it about Jesus, kind of make it Christian-y, you know? So did he in Bethel, sacrificing unto the calves that he had made, and he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. So he offered upon the altar which he had made in Bethel the 15th day of the 8th month, even in the month which he had devised of his own heart. This is do-it-yourself religion. He devised it in his own heart. He just came up with it. He just dreamed it up. There's a lot of religion out there, a lot of Christian so-called religion that is devised in a preacher's own heart. Just dreamed up, just made up. And ordained a feast unto the children of Israel, and he offered upon the altar and burnt incense. God didn't appreciate that. The thing became a sin, it says. And the Bible warns us against the celebration of religious holy days or holidays. Let's look at Colossians 2, 14 through 17. The Bible even warns us not to keep Jewish holy days, which at one time God had commanded the children of Israel to keep. So, obviously God does not want you keeping pagan holy days, but he even tells Christians, don't even keep my old holy days that are now done away with. They're put away. Don't even keep those ones. And that's another thing you'll find. You get out there on the internet and you start finding people that don't celebrate Christmas, and plenty of them find me around this time of year. I get all kinds of emails and things. I get a lot of correspondence with people, and it happens frequently where people will leave a comment and they'll say, do you celebrate the Old Testament feasts? Because yes, we agree with you. We should not be celebrating Christmas. That's pagan. But we ought to be celebrating the Old Testament feast days, the holy days, in other words. No, we shouldn't. We're not Jews. We never were Jews. We've never been under that law which told them to celebrate those holy days. And even people that are Jews, you're not celebrating those holy days anymore anyway. That testament is put away and the New Testament is into effect, and you worship God according to the New Testament, not the old. Let me read it to you. Colossians 2, 14 through 17. And I will go back to this passage in next week's sermon and answer this, because believe it or not, people actually use this verse to try to say that you should not stand in judgment of them for celebrating Christmas. It's like completely turning it on its head, and I won't get into it now. I'll get into it next Sunday. Colossians 2, 14. Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. He's talking about the ordinances of the Old Testament. And having spoiled principalities and powers, he made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in it. Let no man therefore, because Christ took away the Old Testament, nailed it to the cross and its ordinances, let no man therefore judge you in meat, that's dietary law, or in drink, or in respect of an holy day, that's the Old Testament feast days, or of the new moon, or of the Sabbath days, which are a shadow of things to come, but the body is of Christ. Those things were a shadow. Imagine Jesus standing here and shining light on him and seeing his shadow, right? Those things were a shadow. You look at the shadow, you can kind of get an idea. I mean, you know, roughly maybe how tall the person is, how wide he is, you know, how broad his shoulders are. But you're not going to see a whole lot from a shadow. It's just, it's pointing to something else. The shadow is pointing to the person that's casting the shadow. When Jesus came, the shadow is not needed anymore because Jesus, the fulfillment of those types and shadows, is here. So we're not to be celebrating Old Testament holy days. And we're not supposed to be celebrating heathen holy days either. Galatians 4:8-10. Galatians 4:8-10. Howbeit then, when ye knew not God, he's talking to Galatians, which were Gentiles before they were converted. Howbeit then, when ye knew not God, ye did service unto them which by nature are no gods. But after that ye have known God, or rather are known of God, how turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements, whereunto ye desire again to be in bondage? Like when you were heathens, right? When you were practicing your heathen religion. Why are you turning back to this kind of stuff? And what is he talking about? Ye observe days and months and times and years. You're going back to your old bondage. Observing calendrical festivals and celebrations. The Jews were trying to bring them back into they were never in there. They were trying to bring them into the Old Testament religion of Moses. They were trying to convince these Gentiles they had to be circumcised. Keep the law of Moses. Keep the law. Right, so they're being dragged back into this holy day celebration stuff that they used to do as heathens. And Paul says, what are you doing? Not supposed to do that. Now, just the general principle is that when you find something that the world loves, chances are you found something that God hates. It's not a universal principle. I don't think God hates ice cream, right? But religiously, you find something that the world loves, and you probably have found something that God hates. Let's look at Luke 16 and verse 15. At least I hope that God doesn't hate ice cream, because I'm looking forward to having some good ice cream on the new earth, I hope. Luke 16 and verse 15. And he said unto them, ye are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knoweth your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. That which is highly esteemed, what men really sing the praises of, God considers it hateful and disgusting. That's what an abomination is. Of course, men universally love Christmas, right? Christmas is highly esteemed among pretty much all men, Christian and heathen alike. And it should be strange, I would think, to Christians that atheists, agnostics, and many other unbelievers all love Christmas. Just that fact alone should make you wonder, like, this is weird. So we're supposedly celebrating the birth of Jesus, but yet all these unbelievers, atheists, agnostics, you know, probably God-hating people out there, they all love Christmas. That's just weird. They love a Christian holiday. That's just strange, isn't it? I mean, it should be. And think about this. You can bet that if the Bible commanded people to celebrate Christmas, they would want nothing to do with it. If God actually told us in the Bible, I want you to celebrate the birth of my son on December 25th, and here's how I want you to do it. I want you to put a green tree in your house. I want you to decorate up with a bunch of lights. I want you to give gifts to your children. I want you to have wreaths and holly and greenery around. I want you to burn a Yule log. And I want you to have some big fat guy in a red suit come and have your children sit on his lap, write him letters, and tell him that he's going to squeeze down the chimney and put gifts under the tree. I want you to do it this way. This is how I want you to honor the birth of my son, Jesus Christ. And the world would say, that is foolishness. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. I will never do something like that. That is the stupidest thing ever. Nobody would do it except for a few little churches out there that actually keep God's commandments, and everybody else would hate it. and make fun of you and say how dumb you are. I guarantee it. The world hates the religion of God. It doesn't love it. I should tell you something about Christmas. The fact that the world loves Christmas is good evidence that God hates it. And then you have this little interesting point here. In Revelation chapter 11, with the two witnesses, which are could possibly be God's word in his church, people have made that argument. But whatever the two witnesses are, when they have lost all their influence, guess what the world starts doing? Revelation 11 and verse 10. And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them and make merry. This is when the witnesses have been killed. They'll rejoice over them and make merry and shall send gifts one to another because these two prophets tormented them that dwelt on the earth. God's witnesses, when their witness is extinguished, what do people start doing? Making merry and sending gifts. In other words, when God's witness on this earth is dead, people start celebrating Christmas. And here we are. And we are hypocrites if we condemn the idolatrous practices of other religions and at the same time incorporate them into our own. Let's look at Romans 2 and verse 1. And then verses 21 and 22. Romans 2 and verse 1. How many Christians out there, professing Christians, would condemn the heathen idolatry of the nations, right? Condemn people that would be idol worshippers, sun worshippers, moon worshippers, astrologers, all that kind of stuff. They would condemn all this kind of pagan idolatry and then bring it right on into their own religion and just call it by a different name. That's what you call a hypocrite right there. Romans chapter 2 and verse 1. Therefore thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest. For wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest doest the same things. Could you really, in good conscience, meet a Wiccan? Because Wiccans, they're witches, Wiccans celebrate the winter solstice. They do. They are irritated with Christians for stealing their holiday. I've actually talked to them online. I've had them correspond with me and say that you guys stole our holiday. And they're right. Could you, as a professing Christian, condemn a Wiccan for celebrating the winter solstice and worshiping the sun when you are literally doing the exact same thing, only you just changed the name of it? Think about it. Verses 21 and 22. Therefore, which teachest another, teachest thou not thyself? Thou that preachest a man should not steal, dost thou steal? Thou that sayest a man should not commit adultery, doth thou commit adultery? Thou that abhorrest idols, dost thou commit sacrilege? Oh yeah, you hate idolatry, do you do it yourself? Good question to ask. And speaking of that brings me to my next point, that the celebration of Christmas is a form of idolatry. I briefly mentioned this. I'm going to expand a bit on it. And church members must abstain from this. We've already seen from the past two sermons already that Christmas is a Christianized version of a sun-worshipping pagan holiday. And therefore, Christmas is essentially Baal worship, because Baal is the sun god. That's why I often refer to Christmas as Baalmas, right? That's my preferred term for it. I don't even like putting Christ's name in it. People say we ought to put Christ back into Christmas. No, we ought to take him out. He should have never been there in the first place. It's Baal worship. I'm not making this up. Here's from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. This is what it says about Baal. This is a bit of a lengthy quote, but I want to show you that Baal was the sun god. The Babylonian Belu or Baal, Lord, is what that means, was the title of the supreme god among the Canaanites. The Babylonian Bel-Merodach was a sun god, and so too was the Can-Baal, whose full title was Baal-Shamaim, Lord, which means Lord of Heaven. The Phoenician writer Sanchuniathon, looks like that's how that might be pronounced, accordingly says that the children of the first generation of mankind, quote, in time of drought, stretched forth their hands to heaven toward the sun, for they regarded him as the sole Lord of heaven, and called him Baal-Samen, or Samin, which means Lord of Heaven in the Phoenician language, which is equivalent to Zeus in Greek. I get this pagan guy. He's a nice fellow. He lives in the same apartment complex that we do. I think he owns the liquor store across the street. And when you'll see him walking in the morning sometimes, and he's holding up his hands to the sun. And I think he's probably some Hindu or something, worshiping the sun, worshiping some false deity or something. And, you know, I had to tell him, you ought to get yourself a Christmas tree and celebrate Christmas. I mean, it's the same deal, and it's a lot more fun. So, anyway, he says, this article continues, Baal-Shemain had a temple at El-Awamid, that's how you pronounce that, between Acre and Tyre, and his name is found in inscriptions from the Phoenician colonies of Sardinia and Carthage. As the sun god, Baal was worshipped under two aspects, beneficent and destructive. On the one hand, he gave light and warmth to his worshippers. On the other hand, the fierce heats of summer destroyed the vegetation he had himself brought into being. Hence, human victims were sacrificed to him in order to appease his anger in time of plague or other trouble, the victim being usually the firstborn of the sacrificer and being burnt alive. In the Old Testament, this is euphemistically termed passing the victim through the fire, 2 Kings 16:3, 2 Kings 21:6. The forms under which Baal was worshipped were necessarily as numerous as the communities which worshipped him. Each locality had its own Baal, or divine lord, who frequently took his name from the city or place to which he belonged. Hence there was Baal-Zer, which means Baal of Tyre, Baal-Hermon, which was Baal of Hermon, Judges 3:3, Baal-Lebanon, which is Baal of Lebanon, Baal-Tars, which was Baal of Tarsus. At other times, the title was attached to the name of an individual god. Thus, we have Bel-Merodach, which is the Lord of Merodach, or Bel is Merodach, is what that means. At Babylon, you have Bel-Melkarth. At Tyre, Bel-Gad, Joshua 11:17, in the north of Palestine. Occasionally, the second element was noun. That might supposed to be say a noun, I'm not sure. Occasionally, the second element was a noun, as in Baal-Shemaim, which means Lord of Heaven, Baal-Zebub, remember Baal-Zebub, right? That's the devil. Baal-Zebub, 2 Kings 1:2, which is Lord of the Flies, Baal-Hamain, usually interpreted Lord of Heat, or more probably, Lord of the Sun Pillar, the tutelary deity of Carthage. All these various forms of the sun god were collectively known as Balaam, or Baals, who took their place by the side of the female Ashtaroth and Ashtrim. Ashtaroth is the pagan goddess of Easter. That's where Easter comes from, is Ashtaroth, or Ishtar, or some of those other names for the pagan fertility goddess. At Carthage, the female consort of Baal was termed Peni Baal, or Penny Baal, the face or reflection of Baal. So Baal was the sun god. And therefore, if you are worshiping the sun, like the pagans did in for Natalis, Solis, and Victi, what were they worshiping but Baal, right? Just like you got that Old Testament Baal worship that Israel kept falling prey to. In the New Testament, guess what? We still have Christians worshiping Baal today. They just call him Jesus, right? The church must separate from idolaters, so we're told. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 11. How do you think Jesus feels when people are worshiping him, when they're really worshiping Baal and just calling Baal by his name? Probably doesn't make him very happy. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 11. But now I have written unto you not to keep company if any man that is called a brother be a fornicator, or covetous, or an idolater, or a railer, or a drunkard, or an extortioner, with such an one know not to eat. And we've looked at this passage many times. This is referring to eating the Lord's Supper with him. This is church discipline, right? So the church must separate from idolaters. And an idolater is a worshiper of idols or images, one who pays divine honors to an image or representation of a god or to any natural object as a deity. So sun worship would fall under idolatry, paying homage to a natural object as a deity, right? That's sun worship, that's Baal worship, that's idolatry. Now, an idol can be something that represents God and is used to worship God, such as was the golden calf that Aaron made and then proclaimed that tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. You see, that was called idolatry too. We've already looked at that. Exodus 32, 5 through 6, and then what Paul said about it in 1 Corinthians 10, 7. When they did that, when they created that idol and then used that idol to help them to worship God, when they had a feast to the Lord and that idol is there present and is part of it, that's called idolatry. Even though they said it was a feast to the Lord, even though people say, I'm worshiping the Lord, I'm keeping the birth of Christ, nonsense. It's idolatry. I don't care what you say. That's what the Bible teaches it is. Incorporating paganism into God's religion is therefore idolatry. Now, you can, you shouldn't, but one can serve the Lord and at the same time serve false gods like Baal. Do you know that? You can serve both. Now, God's not happy with that, but it's not impossible to serve both. You can serve both and then get in trouble with God. Israel did this in Samuel's day. They worshipped Baal and Ashtoreth and the Lord. 1 Samuel 7, 3 through 4. And guess what? They were getting oppressed by the Philistines because of that. 1 Samuel 7, 3 through 4. And Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel, saying, if ye do return unto the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the strange gods and Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve him only. Serve him only. Right? They have been serving him and Ashtaroth and the other gods. Serve the Lord only. And he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. Then the children of Israel put away Balaam. Remember, that's the Baals. Balaam and Ashtaroth, and serve the Lord only. So you can serve them both. I'll give you another example. This one's even more clear. 2 Kings 17 and verse 33. 2 Kings 17, 33. This is the Samaritans. After the northern kingdom had thoroughly irritated God, he sent in the Assyrians, and they conquered the northern kingdom, and they took out most of the Jews and took them into the land of Assyria, and then they brought in a bunch of heathens and brought them to the land of Israel, and those people became the Samaritans. And they worshiped the false gods, their false gods, and they worshiped the Lord. They worshiped them both. And it's summed up here in verse 33, 2 Kings 17, 33. And the problem was that they started getting eaten by lions. So they're like, hey, bring a priest in here and teach us how to worship the Lord, how to teach us how to fear the Lord, because we're getting eaten by these lions. So they brought a priest in and taught them how to fear the Lord. But the problem was, yeah, they feared the Lord, but then they also served the other gods as well. It says they feared the Lord and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from thence. And then down in verse 41, so these nations feared the Lord and served their graven images, both their children and their children's children, as did their fathers, so do they unto this day. That's why when it says the Jews would have no dealings with the Samaritans, it's because they were a bunch of pagans. They had amalgamated, I think that's the word, they had amalgamated the worship of false gods with the worship of the true God. They were modern day Christians, in other words, right? Paganism, God's religion, kind of merge them all together there. Fear the Lord and serve your own gods. So you can do both, but you shouldn't. So in other words, Israel had been incorporating pagan sun worship. Remember, they were serving Balaam, right? Pagan sun worship, that's what Baal is. They have been incorporating pagan sun worship with the worship of the true God. Can you imagine such a thing? Exactly what Christians are doing today. incorporating pagan sun worship with the worship of the true God. And if Israel were to be saved from their enemies, they would only be by forsaking their pagan worship and serving God only. That was what Samuel told them if they wanted to be delivered out of the hand of the Philistines. And if churches are going to be spared judgment today, it will be by forsaking pagan worship and worshiping God in spirit and in truth. Why do you think one of the reasons is, anyway, that churches are in such a mess today? Why are churches failing? Why are churches dying out? True churches, right? There's a lot of churches that are dying out. Why is that? Well, maybe because they've gone the way of the heathen. Look at all these old Baptist churches around here. A lot of them are all closed down. It's happening all over the country. Why? Well, one of the reasons is they've gone the way of the heathen. A lot of them celebrate Christmas. There'd be other reasons too, but that's one. You know, the Bible teaches that judgment must begin in the house of God, 1 Peter 4:17. And if it doesn't begin there, well, we're in big trouble. Now, another aspect of this that I mentioned earlier is that covetousness is a form of idolatry. Let me just give you a couple of verses. Colossians 3 and verse 5. I really want to hammer home this point that the celebration of Christmas is idolatry. Colossians 3 and verse 5. It says, "Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry." So now that expands out idolatry a bit, because now covetousness is equated with idolatry. So if you are covetous, you are committing idolatry. Ephesians 5 and verse 5 is another one. Ephesians 5 and verse 5. "For this ye know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God." Now, covetousness is a driving force behind the celebration of Christmas. You ever listen to little kids around Christmas time? You're going to hear two words repeated over and over and over again. "I want, I want, I want, I want." You know what that is? You know what that is being interpreted? "I am covetous. I am covetous. I am covetous." Or, "I'm an idolater. I'm an idolater. I'm an idolater." That being interpreted. Those who are commonly known to practice idolatry by incorporating paganism into God's religion, such as celebrating Christmas, which is pagan sun worship, will be put out of the church. Galatians 5, 19 through 21. This is not just a preference of ours. It's not a suggestion that, well, we don't think you should celebrate Christmas. No, it is you will not. Or you will not be a member of this church, period. Galatians 5, 19 through 21. "Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of the which I tell you before, as I have told you also in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God." You got idolatry there, which I've already proved extensively that Christmas is idolatry. Witchcraft, remember I told you that Wiccans, which are witches, they honor the sun, the solstice worship. And then you have revelings as well, which definitely goes along with at least some people's Christmas celebrations, where they get a little bit too far into the booze. All right, now, one more thing that I want to cover in this sermon today is what constitutes celebrating Christmas. Because I get questions like this, and I should have covered this in the past. I've explained this to people personally, but I don't know that I've really ever preached on it, so I thought that this would be good to cover. Because people will often, you know, ask me, well, what is considered celebrating Christmas? A lot of times these are honest questions, and then some of them are more like, what can I get away with kind of thing. So the following things, doing these would definitely be considered celebrating Christmas. So there's black and white, and then there's some gray areas. Okay, these are the black and white ones. Having a Christmas tree in your home, that is celebrating Christmas, period. That is not going to happen. Decorating your house for Christmas, that's not going to happen. Now, if you like to have white lights on your house and you have them all year long and you leave them up for December, I don't care a bit about it. I think white lights are nice. Yeah. But if you happen to put up white lights after Thanksgiving and take them down at New Year's and say, oh, yeah, I just like white lights, we're going to have a talk because I don't believe you. Taking kids to see Santa Claus, obviously celebrating Christmas. In stupidity, in lying to your children, and teaching them all kinds of bad ideas. Giving or receiving gifts on or close to Christmas Day that are obviously intended to be Christmas gifts. I had some friends one time that gave up celebrating Christmas until Christmas time came around, and they went up to the parents' house on Christmas Day and exchanged gifts with each other, but they weren't celebrating Christmas. You know, they were not celebrating Christmas by exchanging gifts on December 25th with each other. Well, if that's how you don't celebrate Christmas, I'm not sure how you do. Hello? Well, I'm not celebrating Christmas. I'm just doing exactly what everybody else does. But in my mind, I'm not celebrating Christmas. Right. Even if that's true, you still can't do it. Even if in your mind you're saying, I'm not celebrating Christmas. I know this is a bunch of nonsense. You still can't do it. And I'll explain why here in a minute. Christmas caroling, as fun as that is, or would be, can't do that, that's celebrating Christmas. Going to Christmas parties of companies and organizations. If it's called a Christmas party, or if it's decorated with Christmas things, don't go. If it's a Christmas party. When I was working for companies, before I was ordained, I never went to any Christmas parties because they were always Christmas parties. I did go to one when I was working for Mathnasium. It wasn't a, I asked specifically, is this a Christmas party or is it just an end of the year party? And he's like, oh no, it's just an end of the year thing. They went to a restaurant or whatever. I'm like, okay, whatever. If it's an end of the year thing and it's not a Christmas party, I'm fine. But if it's a Christmas party, don't go. The Chamber, I'm a member of the Chamber of Commerce here. We have luncheons every month. And in December, they have the holiday luncheon. It's at the Elms. And it's the biggest, most fun one, and they give out all kinds of awards, and people dress up, and they got great, you know, the Elms really caters it nicely and everything. I don't go, because it's a Christmas luncheon. It is specifically said to be Christmas. It's decorated up as Christmas. I don't go. I would love to go. If those pagans would just not make it Christmas and just say it's an end-of-the-year celebration, I'd go in a heartbeat. But it's a Christmas thing, so therefore you don't go. Like I said, if it's an end-of-the-year party and it's not Christmas-themed, yeah, that'd be all right. Having Christmas dinner with family if they are getting together for the celebration of Christmas. And it's all about what they're doing. If they are getting together to celebrate Christmas, don't go, because then you are celebrating along with them. Even if you in your mind aren't doing it, I'll get to that in a second. And then participating in civic Christmas celebrations, like they have the Christmas parade here. They actually had it before Thanksgiving. These people, they can't even wait until one holiday's over to start the next. They start doing Christmas before Thanksgiving even starts. And as a matter of fact, they start doing Christmas before Halloween even starts. I mean, it's crazy. But anyway, yeah, don't. I would not go to the Christmas. What did I just call it? A parade. Couldn't think of the word. Terrible. Don't go to a Christmas parade. You know why? Because it's a Christmas parade. That's why. And it's not rocket science. Now, what about going home for Christmas or getting together with family at that time of year? Because some people live far away from home. Some people have time off work. A lot of people have time off work. At that time of year, they got maybe even have the whole week off. Can I go home and hang out with my family around that time of year? The answer is, it depends. It depends. If your family is getting together on December 25th for the purpose of celebrating Christmas, and 99.9% of all of them are, right? If your family is getting together on December 25th for the purpose of celebrating Christmas, you should not attend that gathering. If you attend such a gathering, you will be giving the impression to your family and other observers that you approve of celebrating Christmas. Okay? And it's going to come down to their perception of what's happening. That's what it's going to come down to. And you say, well, why am I judged because of their perception? Go ask Paul about it. He asked the same thing. Why am I judged of another man's conscience? Because you are. That's why. A family member who might have a secret conscience issue with celebrating Christmas could be led to violate his conscience and continue to celebrate Christmas because he sees you doing it. Right? There might be a family member of yours that has heard you talk about this. Maybe they've heard a video on YouTube about how Christmas is pagan, and maybe their conscience is nagging at them, thinking, you know what? I don't think this is right. I probably shouldn't be doing this. I wonder if I should even be here. And then in comes Mr. Christian, who says he doesn't celebrate Christmas, but then he's right there, and then the person says, well, I mean, if he's here, must be all right. I guess it must be all right to celebrate, right? I mean, he wouldn't be here if it's not, right? This is not a far stretch. Paul uses a very similar analogy to this about being invited to a feast at an idol's temple. See, this family member could end up going against his conscience because of what he sees you doing. Paul said that even though that we know an idol is nothing, there are some people that don't have that knowledge, and they might eat food as if it were offered to an idol and defile their conscience because of it. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 4. 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 4. And the other thing is, you don't want to look like a hypocrite. That's the other thing that they'll do, is they'll charge you with hypocrisy. They'll invite you over for Christmas dinner, and then as soon as you come, they'll say, oh, I didn't think you celebrate Christmas. And they'll charge you with hypocrisy. One time at a company I worked for, people would bring in cookies around that time of year, and I ate one of the cookies, and somebody said, I thought you didn't celebrate Christmas. That was the last cookie I ate. I'm not going to give you a reason to blaspheme the name of God. I'm not going to give you a reason to condemn me and say I'm a hypocrite for celebrating Christmas. I'm not going to eat a cookie. I won't eat a cookie while the world stands. That's what Paul said. I mean, he didn't say cookie, but he said, I'll eat no meat while the world stands if it's going to cause somebody to stumble. I didn't eat another cookie. Did my health good and my spirit good. 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 4. As concerning, therefore, the eating of those things which are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. Now, if somebody invited you to an idol's temple, and this is what he goes on to say, I mean, technically, an idol is just nothing. It's a piece of stone. It's a piece of wood. It's not really a god. It's nothing. And if nobody else was around, I'd go and eat a ham sandwich in an idol's temple. Who gives a care? It doesn't matter, right? It's just some idol. It's just some block of wood. But as soon as there's an idolater there thinking that I'm eating that ham sandwich in honor of that idol, all of a sudden it's a problem. My mind hasn't changed one bit. It's what he thinks. It's what he thinks which determines what I do. You say, well, that's not fair. Well, tough. That's just the way it is. Verses 7 through 12. Howbeit, there is not in every man that knowledge. For some with conscience of the idol unto this hour eat it as a thing offered unto an idol. And their conscience being weak is defiled. You know, that guy sees you sitting there at an idol's temple and you're eating food. And he's like, well, apparently this guy must be okay with serving this idol because he's eating the food and I'll do it too. And then he violates his conscience because he thinks, oh, this is probably not right, but he's doing it, so it must be all right. But meat commendeth us not to God, neither if we eat are we the better, neither if we eat not are we the worse. But take heed lest by any means this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to them that are weak. For if any man see thee, which hast knowledge, sit at meat in the idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him that is weak being emboldened to eat those things which are offered to idols. And through thy knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when ye sin so against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, ye sin against Christ. Wherefore, if meat make my brother to offend, I will eat no flesh while the world standeth, lest I make my brother to offend. Another thing you have to consider also, and maybe even a closer parallel, is let's say you are fully persuaded in your mind that Christmas is just some foolish pagan holiday. It's got nothing to do with the birth of Jesus. And, you know, to go there and to eat dinner with my family, I can just totally separate the two and say, I'm just having dinner with my family. I don't care about Christmas. I'm not doing anything about Christmas. But maybe a brother in the church that's weaker sees you doing that and saying, well, it must be okay to go to the family's place for Christmas. And then he goes to the family's place for Christmas, but now he's not as strong as you are. And then, they start giving him gifts and he starts taking them. And before you know it, he's celebrating Christmas against his conscience. But I saw the other guy do it. It must be okay, right? That's why you don't want to do that. Therefore, we should abstain from eating meat sacrificed to idols or eating meat in an idol's temple because of the construction others might put upon it. It's about what construction they put on it. Like in verse 13, wherefore, if meat make my brother to offend, I will eat no flesh while the world standeth, lest I make my brother to offend. He talked about the same kind of thing a couple of chapters later in chapter 10, 1 Corinthians 10, 28 through 33. He said, but if any man say unto you, this is if you're invited. If you're invited if you're invited to a meal to eat, don't ask any questions, he says. Don't worry about it. Somebody says, hey, you want to come over for dinner? If it's some pagan you work with or whatever, sure, I'll come. Don't ask any questions. But if any man say unto you, this is offered in sacrifice unto idols. You know, imagine you get invited over by a Hindu co-worker of yours or something, and you're there and you're having dinner, and he says, oh, by the way, this was sacrificed to whatever their some Hindu god is. At that point, you got to say, sorry, I can't eat that. Do you have a ham sandwich? Right? I can't eat that food. If that was sacrificed to idols, you know, give me something else. Of course, the food hasn't changed one bit, but it's what he thinks, right? That's the problem. But if any man say unto you, this is offered in sacrifice unto idols, eat not for his sake that showed it, and for conscience sake, for the earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof. Conscience, I say, not thine own, but of the other. For why is my liberty judged of another man's conscience? For if I by grace be a partaker, why am I evil spoken of for that which for which I give thanks? Whether therefore ye eat or drink or whatsoever ye do, do all to the glory of God. Give none offense, neither to the Jews, nor the Gentiles, nor the church of God. Even as I please all men in all things, not seeking mine own profit, but the profit of many that they may be saved. So we have to consider other people when we make these decisions. The same reasoning applies to going to a Christmas dinner with one's family. We should abstain from doing so because it might give them the impression that it's okay to celebrate Christmas. And we don't want to do that. Now, if your family is getting together on December 25th simply because they all have the day off work and they're not doing so to celebrate Christmas, then it's fine to go. This is not going to happen very often because most people do, but for instance, in this church, if your family is having a get together just to eat dinner or whatever, or like we are having a little something at our house just as a get together because people are off work, no problem with that. We're not celebrating Christmas. There's no indication that any celebration of Christmas is happening there. So that would be fine. If you want to travel to see family at Christmas time during your vacation, then plan the trip so that you're not there on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day when they're exchanging gifts and celebrating the holiday. Right? So now I realize that that can really mess up your plans, but nobody ever said it was easy to be a Christian, did they? So sometimes you just have to make sacrifices. If for some reason you must be at a family member's house during the Christmas celebration, maybe there's a funeral during that same week or something, some reason you're traveling and you just happen to be passing through and it's that time of year, it's that week or whatever. If you just happen to be there and you didn't, you know, plan it so you were there for Christmas, you just happened to show up or whatever. If you happen to be there, make it clear to everyone that you do not celebrate Christmas and go to another room of the house while they partake of their pagan festivities. And that will speak volumes to them. You don't have to say a word except for, I don't celebrate Christmas, we're going to the basement or whatever, let us know when you're done. Let me tell you what, that will be more effective than giving them an hour-long sermon about why they shouldn't celebrate Christmas. That will speak volumes to them. So next time I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to answer some other questions about receiving gifts from family members around Christmas time and gifts around that time of year. And then I also want to talk about, I want to answer some arguments, some common arguments that people make in support of celebrating Christmas. And these are some of the most common ones that I get all the time. And so I thought it would be a good thing to have those, you know, be aware of those. So when somebody hits you with it, then you've got the answer and you don't need to be stammering and not know what to say. So thank you.